It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I'm Tim Callender this week.
I'm Summer Brooks.
And for your entertainment pleasure, I'll be Jeffrey Willarth.
Fantastic. Well, we were originally going to have Gary from Jacksonville on tonight, but it turns out that kind of fell through, so we had to go back to Plan B.
Yeah, just the good old same, you know, Tim, Summer, and Jeffrey.
Yeah, that's right. That's how we have to. That's how we have to be.
Holy cow! It's
yeah. Go ahead, do your best imitation. That'd be great. That'd be good stuff.
And how about those Dodgers this week? I tell you, I was sitting back with a Dos Equis in my hot tub, and I was just loving their game. Okay, that's all I got.
Yeah, that wasn't bad though. Okay, well, unfortunately, Summer is not feeling well. She's under the weather, and so everybody's sending good healing vibes across the plains of the ether toward her. And
no
hopefully
better,
she'll
Summer.
Be back. Yep. Boop. And since we're speaking of women who are not doing well, let's talk about a list, Gary, that you actually sent to us from the Completely Useless Guide to B5. This is 10 women who get a really raw deal in B5. Are you ready?
Go for it.
Starting with number 10, Delenn, tortured by a Vorlon Inquisitor, marries bloke with a messiah complex, is dumb enough not to spot her aide going loopy. Oh, and she started the Earthman-Bari War. Number 9, Lise Hampton, has a happy marriage to the richest man in the solar system, cut short by Bester, ends up married to the baldest man in the solar system. Number 8, number 1. Leader of the Mars Resistance Movement, for what that's worth. Number 7, Catherine Sakai, whatever happened to her? Number 6, Julie Misante, Nightwatch agent who tries to vamp Sheridan in Voices of Authority. She fails to tempt him to go where everyone had gone before and just leaves. Number 5, Susan Ivanova, second in command on B5, and yet when her boss was mysteriously posted to Minbar as ambassador, she didn't even get an interview for the vacancy. Then she got written out with a vague passing mention. Number 4, Anna Sheridan, brainwashed by the shadows solely to serve as bait for her husband and eventually nuked by him. Number 3, Natoth, Narn diplomatic aide, vanished without trace or even comment for 3 years until mysteriously discovered in a Centauri prison cell. Number 2, Talia Winters, now believed to be a brain in a jar at Psi-Corps headquarters. And number 1 woman who got a really raw deal in B5... Lita Alexander, not only reprogrammed by the Vorlons and turned into a walking time bomb, she also fell for an obviously dodgy rebel telepath. And since we're on segues, that will segue into our deep geeking for tonight on the episode Secrets of the Soul. How is that?
Oh, that's a real high-quality professional show there.
Yeah, if you look here, you can see a tear coming out of my eye because I'm moved.
It's moving. Yeah.
Yeah. Or I have to have a movement or something.
Well, Gary's in the hot tub, so I don't know where that leaves you. Anything else, gents, before we take a break and go into the deep geeking?
No, I'm ready to stick it off.
Yeah, all right.
Oh, actually, I take that back. Wait a second. I did just get the new Asked and Answered Part 2. And
yeah.
I'm a little disappointed. I was hoping for some sort of introduction for every book, but it just does plow right into the materials. It ranges from fan interaction to production of Babylon 5. And it's filled with, little things. Let me see if I can find something that would be nice, short, and quick for this little segment before we go off.
Well, it'll be nice and short if you don't ask Tim to do anything.
I resemble that remark. You can't find it.
They're all rather long and intricate, so I'll have to skip on that for right now. Maybe. Yep, yeah. Why would I want to take up a good voicemail with online conversation?
That's a good point. Exactly. All right, then. Well, we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back with Deep Geeking on Secrets of the Soul.
How to continue a television series after a major actor has left the cast.
The Robin of Sherwood method.
Remove the character from the scripts and replace him with an entirely similar character. Create a highly elaborate scenario that puts the new character into the same situation as the original.
The transition is completed when the replacement character adopts the same name as his predecessor. For more about British science fiction television, listen to the British Invaders podcast
at www.britishinvaders.com.
Digging down into the most obscure facts in fandom, this is
And we are back with some Deep Geeking. Tonight is the episode Secrets of the Soul.
Yes, we
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say this one was directed by Tony Dow, and you know, he had a really daunting challenge in this one as far as shooting scenes.
Yes, indeed. And it is a scene that I think generally for any television show like a Babylon 5, you know, not necessarily science fiction, but something that's on a syndicated level like it was, I think that was a, you know, that was a risky scene. And the fact that
I guess it relates to, you know, Warner Brothers being hands off and letting Joe actually write what he wants to write.
Yeah, and the other part of it is it's not gratuitous. You know, it starts off feeling like it's going to be kind of a gratuitous scene. But it becomes almost – well, it does become a pivotal moment in the whole telepath colony arc.
Well, I mean, it seems like without dancing around it too much, that it was about to happen for a long time. It wasn't a shock or a surprise when that whole scene occurred.
Right. Right, and okay, we'll be blunt about it. It is indeed the sex scene between Byron and Lita. And it's funny, I was looking at the Lurker's Guide, and JMS notes that in his script, he actually does, as he's describing it, and he says it was scripted out in a very detailed form, and I haven't seen the script book for it, but he types out, I wonder which is more embarrassing, reading this or writing it. So, but it is one of those, you know, I recall when it first aired and that first moment when, you know, Lita tells Byron, you know, take your rest in me, and they kind of fall gently to the floor and she peels off her top, and I'm like going, oh, you know, oh gosh. And then when she mentions, you know, and then even the whole little bit, I haven't been with anyone, and I'm sitting there going, oh God, until she gets to the point where she says, I haven't been with anyone since the Vorlons changed me.
I know. I was almost hoping that there'd be some, I mean, we know she had the gills, but you wonder what else she meant by that.
Well, I that was what's interesting. I think it gets back to something that Talia Winters told Commander Sinclair back in Mind War, that when telepaths make love, it's so completely, totally open. You know, it's an intimacy unlike anything else anybody else knows. And I think that's what Lita was originally driving at, was she didn't know because it you almost get the sense just from that statement that there's a not exchange of power, but it's like you don't hold back anymore. The telepaths, as is constantly mentioned in the show, they're always holding back. They're always blocking. They're always keeping things in check. And this is a moment where they drop all those barriers and let everything out. So I think she was more concerned that she would probably fry his brain.
Well, you know, both the previous episode with Bester and this one makes me wonder how much power Lita really has. It, you know, at first it seems to be this, you know, what, doomsday weapon, although in practical purposes it seems much more limited.
Well, you get further on further along in the series, I can't remember the title of the episode, where she's basically controls everybody in the Zocalo. when Lockley and Zach go to lock her up. So that indicates a fair amount of power. But back to the point here, I think that's kind of what she's driving at. But what really happens is she opens up to all the memories that come from whatever it was that the Vorlons had implanted in her. And that completely changes the tenor of Byron's crusade.
Oh, it really does. I mean, he goes from he basically realizes that telepaths were tools. They were nothing but, you know, guns waiting to be fired. And I think it actually enraged him. He went from sort of what I felt was a real pacifist, you know, let me be. And I think I sensed in the actor, like, an anger from that, a really strong anger that definitely would change the way he would do things.
Right, and I agree, and I think that's one of the ironies of it is that Byron, up to that point, had been struggling against that darker nature, and you remember how he gets to talking with Lita about who killed the thugs and down below. You know, as you recall, now we got to kind of go back to the beginning, where they're walking through down below and they get accosted by the thugs, and Byron allows the one to beat him, you know, to smack him around a little bit, and
yeah.
Right, hit me again. You know, how was one different from the last? Wouldn't it be any different or better, you know, had you done more? But the fact was, in a sense, the telepaths in the colony reflect that dichotomy of Byron, because as he's telling Lita in that scene, he says, I can't believe that they did that violence. Not all of them, but some of them. But the fact of the matter is, when you see Byron's manner change, when he realizes that they've been bred to be cannon fodder, that the capacity for that violence that Byron's been trying to deny has just simply been lurking under the surface.
Well, I mean, as they give his history with Bester, that he was a protege of his, you know, he has to have a side that's not, you know, all, you know, sun daisies and, you know, running through a field of green grass. He had to have, you know, an edge about him. He wouldn't have been Bester's protege if he didn't have some of the same characteristics.
Right. Good point. And that's one of the things that I find fascinating about the Byron character, is I think that with the writing and the performance by Robin Akins down, is that dichotomy is really is there, and it's apparent, but it's very well portrayed and very well performed. And that was the thing when Byron stands up and he starts, you know, spelling it out, the Vorlons did this to us, you really get the sense that in a way his whole quest to be nonviolent and establish a peaceful colony for telepaths it wasn't because he had come to a place of acceptance. It was because in the denial that society treated telepaths with, he was also trying to deny that. You know, there was a double denial there, because he's so quick to come along rather than say, you know, well, this is who we are. You know, as Lita's trying to tell him, it's like, you know, the Vorlons did this, but they're not around. You know,
absolutely. And, you know, back to this whole change in Byron, I think he would have been a much more popular character if this had happened a little earlier on. I think his whole wistful portrayal is part of the point that sort of irritated people about him, that he was so nonchalant, that he seemed to really not take an interest in anything, just wanting to be left alone. I would have loved to seen an extra episode or two of this more, you know, forceful, determined Byron than we got. It did change the character for me. He became much more likable at this point.
Yeah, see, I never had that problem with Byron. I always found him to be a fascinating character, and a different character than what we'd seen in Babylon 5 up to this time. And and a lot of it comes from how he's relating to the other characters, and I think as much as it's the whole situation. And this is one of those – this is that defining moment where He comes on the station. He convinces Sheridan that all they want to do is just live their lives and be left alone. Sheridan, against his better judgment, you know, and from that moment on, everybody's caught in a bind, and that's where the situation becomes interesting because all the characters are acting out of what they perceive to be the right thing to do. You know, Sheridan says this is what the Interstellar Alliance is all about, giving people who have no voice a voice, giving everyone an opportunity for freedom. So he allows them to come on the station. Well, that automatically puts Lockley in a bind because these citizens are and they are all human. That's the thing. You know, there's no Centauri telepaths among them, no Minbari telepaths, no telepaths from any other races. So despite the fact that it is the seat of the Interstellar Alliance on a temporary basis, Babylon 5 is still under Earth Alliance jurisdiction and its laws. And so now Lockley is caught in a bind. So she has to do some legal dancing to not only appease the authorities to whom she's answerable to, but also to appease the president of the Interstellar Alliance, who in a sense does hold greater sway. But what does that do? That just puts Byron and his people in a place where other people are resenting them, and you know those frustrations start bubbling over, and it's amazing that everybody is trying to do the right thing, and yet the whole thing is just going to blow up.
Well, yeah, I mean Byron and all the telepaths are now stuck in this from the last episode, this 60-day waiting period. They're not allowed to leave the station, so they know that Bester's coming back with Bloodhound units again. And, you know, I imagine that they're starting to feel rather pressed and, you know, sort of what do we do now? We're not getting the help we were promised. And now we're stuck here waiting for Bester to come back. So,
right.
Yeah,
and meanwhile,
they're packed against the wall.
Yeah. And meanwhile, you know, thugs are beating them up and they just tired of taking it. And earlier in the episode, Byron's own frustration really starts to bubble to the surface. His frustration with Zach when he gets locked away. You know, I love that scene where they're finally letting him loose. And, you know, Byron the whole time has really tried to take that Gandhi role, you know, the nonviolent resistance. But when Zach says, you know, this guy, you know, we got reports of him, you know, hassling your people, and now he's dead. You wouldn't know anything about that. And Byron's frustration is very real, where he says, you know, how could I know? Because he had me locked up.
Well, I find it odd, just as a side note, that they put Byron in handcuffs all the time. Real effective with a telepath.
Well, you know, you got to do something, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, they don't talk about giving him the sleepers like they did to Bester when they arrest him, or at least they didn't show it, but they'll put handcuffs on him.
Well, that's a good point, and that's, you know, and I wonder if there is a I wonder if there's, you know, a legal thing in there that's never been discussed, but that's a good point, Gary. That does speak to something about the society, or at least the cultural perception of it. You know, that they do have some sort of legal rights. At any rate, that they can't just dope them up.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know they had no problem injecting Bester, but I guess maybe that might have just been the point of being going to war and worried about, you know, all their secrets being exposed was so severe that now in retrospect to just Byron's civil unrest, it's just not the same thing.
Right. Exactly. I think you hit it on the head when Bester's a special case. Let's face it. You know, you know, that man's got his own agenda, and whatever he's there for, you know, he's got his own reasons for doing it. You know, even if he's there to hold out a hand of peace, you got to see what the other hand's doing. So, it's interesting because as the episode closes, and Byron says, you know, up to that point, he'd always been, you know, we're just looking for a place to live peaceably. And now he says, you know, we were made this way. We could have lived normal lives, but we couldn't because of the Vorlons. The Vorlons made us so that we could fight the war for the people that are still here. And now we're going to ask them for a world. And when Lita says, you know, well, what if they don't give you one? It says, we'll make them. That's the key change right there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the point where you know that the old Byron is just gone. He's packed up and, you know, on his way, and this new one's there. And, you know, there were so many worlds that they could have chosen from. I mean, of course, like the Vorlon homeworld was still off limits, but the, you know, the Marcap homeworld might have been a great thing, and it would have been a nice symmetry and a weave back into earlier plot lines where you had basically, you know, a planet that was, you know, abandoned because everybody died. And so, you know, between, you know, everyone being dead and telepaths, it might have been enough to keep most people away from it.
Well, here's another one for you. What about the Minbari? You remember in Legacies where the young girl is basically taken in by Delenn to head for Minbar, where she would be trained with Minbari telepaths. So why not just set up a colony in Minbari space?
Well, that's possible. I always viewed that as more of a something like Delenn trying to get people to have more faith and trust in her, rather than you know, something that is typically done by the Minbari.
Oh, and I'm not saying it's typically done, but I'm thinking, you know, at that point, if you're John Sheridan, you're president of the Interstellar Alliance, and you're looking for a solution to the problem, why not just basically use Babylon 5 as a clearing space? Okay, well, you can't interfere if the bloodhounds do show up. I mean, treat it like it was the Underground Railroad back in season 2 when Franklin was running it. Just make it above ground. And the fact of the matter is, you know, if you're a telepath and you manage to make it to Babylon 5 onto a Minbari transport heading out, you're free and clear. Okay, but because it's an Earth Alliance establishment, if you just happen to run afoul of the bloodhounds, we can't really help you.
Well, true, but, well, and gosh, you can only project so far, but, you know, if you want to think of it in Earth terms, you know, he had all those things that he was being controlled by Minbari and that they were really running the show during the whole Earth Civil War, that, gosh, it would seem a lot, you know, unrealistic that he would choose that option because it would make him look weak and just sort of play into probably what are still sympathizers saying that, you know, he was on the Minbari were pulling his strings all along.
Yeah, I guess that's a point. And it could also be that, you know, in the end, that's just a fatal flaw on the part of Sheridan, that he did not even consider any other options. You know, that it was, you know, and this is fair. I mean, I don't think this is bad writing. You know, there are situations, we've all been in them, where we get into either or thinking. And we fail to see any other alternatives.
Well, so sometimes they're not always good alternatives. That's true, or at least not what you would want.
Right. So, having said all that, I think what's interesting is, well, here's one other thing that I noticed, and then we'll go on to the other story. In Byron's little sleeping space, there is the Danger High Voltage box.
Okay.
So, well, you remember in Dust to Dust when Shakar is given the visions by Kosh, and Kosh walks away, and behind him was the danger sign or the warning sign on the wall?
Oh, I see. A little bit of foreshadowing in a sense.
Yeah, right. Or at least a sign that says there's more here than what you expect.
Hey, stupid, pay attention. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we get the one secret of the soul with the manipulation of the Vorlons with the various other races making telepaths for their war as cannon fodder. We get the other secret of the soul with the Hayek.
Oh, yes. And, you know, that was really – I often wonder which one would you consider the A story and the B story of these, because – gosh, I lean towards the Hayek story being the A story and Byron being the B.
Until the very end, when Byron says, we'll make them give us a homeworld, that you realize that maybe the episode was more about one or the other. I'm with you. I think ostensibly the A story is Dr. Franklin stumbling across the secret of the Hayek and, you know, what's going to happen to them. But you know, I don't know. I think with Babylon 5 and so many ways, when you start looking at the episodes and thinking about the show as a whole, it's difficult to think of terms of A story and B story.
That's true. People use them to separate them, but I, when I'm watching the show, I don't usually see it that way. It seems much more enmeshed than that. Although, you might want to consider the A story being Dr. Franklin talking to the Pachmara.
Yeah, I loved that scene. That was so wonderful. And you get more of a sense of what the Pachmara are like. You know, everybody treats them as they're just kind of, you know, gross carrion eaters. That's the general sense you get from the universe. But the Pachmara in that one scene, you get a sense of their arrogance. They are chosen of God. And that's why they don't interact with other races. Like, you know, other races don't interact with them because they think of them, tendency to think of them as disgusting creatures. The Pachmara,
they are disgusting creatures. You know, they eat dead waste. You know, doesn't look like they bathe much. I've heard some disturbing rumors about what that hump on their back is.
I'm trying to be open-minded that all people, all individuals are just a facet of the universe.
True, but I do have to agree with the Pachmara. I've had some of that barium stuff for some tests. I would have thrown it up too.
That was good stuff. That was so funny. Yeah.
Well, I love how Franklin was so confident that, oh no, it'll be fine. And then you just hear the sound of the guy going and
Yeah.
So much now, for your medical knowledge.
Right. And one of the things that I really like is I think this is one of those rare episodes where we really get to see Dr. Franklin in his element.
Oh yeah, reminds much more of some of the earlier, you know, season 2 episodes as he's, you know, with the Gloppet Egg or some of his, you know, like you said, the Underground Railroad with the clinic down below with the healing machine.
Right. Yeah. And I like how he's portrayed as just a guy who's curious and won't let it go. And that's what I find interesting is that it seems as though the Hayek gerontocracy recognized somehow that Franklin would be the guy who would go digging. You know, as he says at the end where, you know, Kieran has the weapon trained on him. And Tal shows up. He's like, you had to know I would go digging for this kind of thing. And it's like, you get the sense that they really were counting on that.
Well, you know, as far as I could tell, they've reached a dead end as far as themselves trying to figure out how to combat this. And so I don't remember the character's name, but that one of them was relieved that, you know, something is going to be done about it.
Yeah, that was Ambassador Tal, and that's what I'm saying is I got the sense from Tal as she's revealing the nature of the problem for the Hayek, that the extermination of the Hayek Doe removed something from their bloodline that's leading them to extinction. That was, you know, as she says, that we could not reveal to the galaxy what our shame was, but now that somebody else has uncovered it, that person can reveal it and then something can be done. As though that was the whole plot the whole time. And that Kieran didn't buy into it because she was still enmeshed in that way of thinking in terms of the shame that the Hayek carried. And it was not to be discussed.
Oh yeah, and it was obviously, you know, a cultural thing. This has been going on for hundreds of years and they've been aware of it the whole time, so it's not like something that, you know, a few people know. It seems to be fairly well known within the culture that, you know, these events are occurring.
Right.
Strikes me as this isn't the only culture we've seen with diminishing populations. The Mimbaris often mention that they're losing, you know, their populations aren't growing either. I wonder if this is something to do with older civilizations. Do they reach a point where they're, you know, just genetic material isn't there enough to, you know, perpetuate the species
without any sort of replenishing of the the material? I mean, because that, now that that raises a really fascinating question. David Sheridan, son of John and Delenn, might be the harbinger of a new revitalized Minbari race.
Well, that's my thought too. Much as they talk about the Hayakdo giving the genetic material, you know, can we go back and say that Sinclair giving his genetic material into the mix maybe started the population swing up?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or am I getting too deep geeking? I don't know.
No, because I'm just because I'm trying to remember when, if, and I don't have the chronology in front of me, and I don't even know if it's in there, where it was determined, at what point in time it was determined that Minbari souls were not being reborn in Minbari bodies, whether it was something that had been happening for a millennia, when Valen first appeared on the scene, or if it was something that was much more recent.
I get the feeling it was recent. It seemed to me the way they talked about it was a great council secret sort of thing. It really it doesn't seem like it was something that was talked about except in hushed tones.
No, I agree, but that doesn't mean it was necessarily a new event.
It just seemed when Delenn was talking about it to someone in the Warrior cast that he seemed a little surprised by the whole thing. Or, of course, that could have just been the DNA issue altogether.
Yeah, right. I don't know. So,
but it's an interesting thought.
Yeah. So, I really, when I first saw this episode, when it aired originally, I wasn't so keen on the Hayak story. It at that point in time seemed like filler to me. But the more I've watched it, the more I really enjoy that tale. I really like watching Franklin basically as a dog with a bone.
Well, for me, it really shows what the Interstellar Alliance can be for. It is for, you know, the communities to join together and help each other, and you don't have a much clearer way of helping somebody than helping their civilization go on.
Right, right. One thing that I noticed – sorry, go ahead.
Well, I feel like it's almost JMS feeding us, you know, here's an example of what the IA can be and what it can do.
Right. Yeah, well, and I think that's one of the things that we see going forward is, you know, your point's a good one. We see where the IA has difficulties dealing with the Centauri Prime issue going forward, dealing with things like setting up a telepath colony. But that doesn't make the whole thing sour, because you get things like Dr. Franklin saying, look, it'll take the resources of the IA to solve your problem, but we can do it. And it won't happen in my lifetime, but we'll get it started. And I think that's an important aspect to remember of this.
It definitely isn't. Go ahead.
I was going to say the other thing that I noticed again watching this episode that I really liked, a similar visual symbology when Ambassador Tal is telling Franklin the development of the extermination of the Hayakdo, how it, the intermarriage between the two species was at first prescribed by as immoral by the religious faction of their culture, and then it was made illegal, and then, you know, as she's describing how it advanced from immorality to illegality to extermination, as she's walking and the camera pans, it what comes between her and the camera is one of these bar-like structures. So it's almost as though she's in jail talking about this, as though, you know, metaphorically,
yeah,
she's describing describing the self-imposed death sentence that they've created here, and you get that visual hint of it with these bars that become like a metaphor for a jail cell. And I really, that was something that struck me, and I was like, wow, that was really subtle, but a really neat bit. So,
although I didn't know which way they were going with it, were they saying how like the history had bound up the whole culture, or whether it was that was sort of what had happened to the Hayakdo?
Well, I think it's both. I think what happened to the Hayakdo was also indicative of what happened to the culture, and the fact that the culture not understanding what the Hayek Dome meant to the Hayek. The Hayek, over time, saw them as lesser citizens and eventually treated them as a problem to be eliminated. And so, yes, while it on the one hand, it's what happened to the Hayek Dome, they were imprisoned and exterminated. In a larger sense, it's what the Hayek did to themselves by doing that. And so it's a metaphor that spans both races.
That's true. And what do you think in general when Dr. Franklin goes on to what I'm going to call a high horse, you know, about, you know, that, you know, your culture's bad or things like that. He's done it in a few different episodes, sort of like, you know, he's on a moral high ground. If we were in another universe, I'd say, you know, he's tampering with directives and things like that. But it just strikes me that he doesn't have much tolerance for cultures that he doesn't agree with. I didn't hear him go into a rant about the Zahn, for example.
Well, it's a little late for the Zahn, but I think that's, you know, that's a good point. You know, it might be that it's a moot point to discuss the Zahn, and in a sense, the issue with the Zahn never came across his desk, so it's not one that he can really, you know, he's not a crusader necessarily going out and looking for moral issues to drumbeat on. But I'll agree with you that always surprised me, you know, when Tal says, "Will you help us?" and he looks at her and goes, "No." I was like, well, "What?"
It's like he condemns them for the killings from thousands of years ago, and it doesn't strike me as much of his foundationist background to, you know, just to be on somebody like that. I guess it's a character shortfall of his.
Right, that's what I was going to say, and it is an uncomfortable one, because otherwise Stephen Franklin is a very likable guy who obviously has concerns for every individual that comes through MedLab.
Oh, but he's very compassionate.
Right, and sometimes I wonder, you know, when I watch that scene, there are times where I think that he is getting on that moral high horse, like you say, but sometimes I wonder if he's getting on that horse more to push the Hayek to do something. In other words, you know, he's quick to say, I can't help you. It's going to take the resources of the IA. But if you keep the secret, nobody's going to be able to help you. But it's kind of a tangled ball of yarn that way, because he does get that moral thing. It's like, I can't forgive you. You know, only the Hayek Duke can. Too bad they're all dead.
Oh, I agree with you. He's definitely trying to push them into action.
Yeah.
Although I don't think that's his sole motivation, or at least that's not what comes across to me. It seems, you know, he is sort of, you know, shaking his finger at them for a lack of a better term.
Yeah, and, I agree.
And he does it more than one time. And like you said, he is so likable and compassionate. It almost seems at odds that he's able to criticize a society but not an individual, or at least not
you know,
much.
I agree with you. I think it's interesting that way. All right, what else have we got here? I think we've pretty much geeked this one to.
I do have one last point, and then I promise I won't try to out-Tim. One thing I found curious is they were shocked that, you know, in I think 7 or 8,000 years of Hayek society, they only had like 800 years of records. And I think about, if you want to say society, our world has, say, you know, 6 or 7,000 years, if you want to use the, you know, the Chinese calendar, for example, that,
right.
Gosh, I don't think by 2262, we would have 250 years at, you know, a 6,000 year recorded history.
And yeah, so I found that
they seemed was, you know, oh my gosh, they only have this long. And I'm like, but probably, you know, Earth Alliance, probably if they got 250 or 300 years, that's out of 6,000, that's probably lucky.
Well, I agree with you. That struck me as kind of odd too. And that was one of those moments where watching it, anybody else probably would have gone by, but Franklin being Franklin, that was that little loose thread that got him unraveling the thing. But I'll take the other side of that. Even if you've got the Earth Alliance with, say, 200, 300 years of history, Well, let's look at it from this analogy. Let's see how far this one goes, okay? The United States has 300 years of history as the United States, okay? But you've got records stretching back thousands of years for Native Americans, okay? If you start really opening up that scope, we've got records that we've been able to read for 10,000 years. Now, they're not necessarily the kinds of records that go into great detail about census and population centers and all the rest, but we have a fair sense of what was happening in prehistory in Mesopotamia, for example. I think that's what was getting Franklin worked up, was that there wasn't any of that kind of stuff.
No, I'll give you that. Yeah, he said there was absolutely nothing prior to that 800-year, you know, expanse. So I right. could definitely see the reasoning.
That would be the equivalent of, again, to use a United States analogy, here's the history of the United States beginning in 1876. Well, what happened prior to that? Don't worry about that. Here, these are all our records. That's all we have. You know, then you.
It's a valid argument. It definitely is.
Yeah. So, anyways, all right. Anything else?
No, I think we've hit on just about everything I can think of for this episode. Yeah, although probably not, and I'll end up calling on voicemail and saying that I forgot something.
I look forward to hearing that voicemail. All right, then. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and take another quick break, and we will be back to close this show out.
Oh, yeah. Let's get this puppy done.
I'm Tim. I'm a carologist.
And I'm Michael, and I'm a carologist.
And I'm Jeffrey, and we are carologists.
Yes.
And you are, too. Okay, let's get right to it.
Toyota hybrid,
Toyota.
The Toyota Camry hybrid, and
yeah,
loved
it was
that car.
Nice car. That
it was
wonderful.
So freaking smart. It was smarter than me.
You take it off road?
About once a year, I play in the sand with it. No,
it just seems that so many people have vehicles that have 4-wheel drive and never use it. Don't even know how to turn it on or why. I really feel like Mazda has always kind of had their finger on the pulse, and yet they don't flaunt that.
Add your voice to the conversation at www.carology.tv.
Okay, and we're back. We got a little bit of feedback to go through here. And let's go ahead and start with some voicemails. What do you say?
Yeah. Voicemails.
Voicemails.
Well, okay.
Wait, Gary's already here.
Well, he couldn't have possibly sent all the voicemails in, could he?
Would I really call and be on the show at the same time? Come on. What kind of idiot would I look like if I did that?
Okay, well, let's go ahead and roll the first voicemail.
Hey, Backbasters, this is Gary, and I'd like to apologize for my lack of email over the past week or so. I hitched myself up with the Parsec Steering Committee, and I'm in the middle of listening to about, 200-plus submissions, and it's really sucking my time. So I apologize for the lack of content. I'll get back on it probably maybe another week, and I'll be through all of these submissions, and I'll be able to start actually listening to again. In the meantime, let me leave us something for discussion, perhaps. Did you know that originally they were going to have, I believe it was Adira, show slits in her back to suggest her, I guess, her reproductive organs, and that the censors actually did ban them, or at least heavily suggest that they not show them? As a result, you didn't get to see several little slits in the back of Adira's back because it would have been, I guess, inappropriate. I'll talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Wow.
Does this guy have anything better to do with his time than call into the show all the time? I mean, and then he starts talking about porn on top of it. He needs a life.
Not only that, but alien porn.
It's sort of like doing a podcast in an alternate universe right now, isn't it?
Well, you know what, Gary? I can make your Parsec submission wade through a lot easier. Just award all the awards to the Babylon podcast and be done with it.
Yeah, there you go.
They wouldn't let me vote on you guys. They said I was too personally involved. I said, I'm not a cast member. They said, you're on almost every show. Forget it.
But I did get the other Gary.
Yeah. But no, I finished all that up and it was a load of fun. I got to hear podcasts that I'd only heard mentioned in names or never even heard of before. And there were a lot of wonderful ones out there. Some pretty good Farpoint Media ones and some other ones as well. But no, there was a lot. There's a lot of quality podcasts out there. You just got to hunt them out.
So in an interesting twist of normal programming censorship, it's interesting that we were able to clearly show the Centauri male genitalia, but not the Centauri female genitalia, which is, if anybody's watched Cinemax once or twice in their life, or Skinemax, as they like to call it, you would find that it would usually be the other way around, huh?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I wonder if it's because the Centauri genitalia were really in action treated more like squid tentacles as opposed to reproductive organs, whereas maybe the female Centauri genitalia would be more obvious that it was what they were meant for?
Yeah, apparently the censors had never seen a human male genitalia flip a playing card quite that same manner.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
That's what they figured they were getting away with, huh?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I was always a little curious because JMS said really that, you know, Warner Brothers and everyone were typically hands off. So I was wondering where this sort of was, this self censorship after he wrote it, or like, I wonder what the tension was that caused this, you know, caused the scene to get removed entirely.
Well, I don't know. As JML mentioned in his interview with us, that the that scene with Londo playing cards and using his Centauri ding dong to cheat with, the comment from the WB production person was, you know, as he was asking, what is this happening? Basically told JMS, I'm going to pretend I didn't ask and you're going to pretend you didn't tell me. And let it go at that. So yeah, I don't know. It's curious. Although that episode was filmed after Born of the Purple, which was the one with Adira. So I don't know. And then, of course, as we see in Secrets of the Soul, we get a full-blown, you know, sex scene when all said and done. Sure, it's shot through a curtain, but it's pretty obvious what's going on there.
Well, it's like we talked about in the Deep Geeking. Yeah, it was really sort of atypical for Babylon 5 to go into that much detail.
Yeah, right.
Ding dong? Really, Tim? Yeah. That was the best you could come up with? Ding dong?
Well, Wiener didn't seem appropriate.
Meat spatula?
It has the flat end.
Oh, boy.
Mike, maybe we better go to the next voicemail.
Jeffrey was wondering what halfway day, July 2nd, is. It means you're halfway through the year. It is the middle of the middle of the year.
So there.
So there. Yeah.
You go.
As opposed to being the middle of the end of the year.
Is that a halfway full year or a halfway empty year? I don't know.
I don't know. Let's not talk about calendar things. Let's move on to the show.
Hey, wait a minute. Well, since we're not talking calendar things, let's talk about emails, which are not calendar things. But all right, well, first one. This comes to us from Brian in New York. He says, first, let me say, wow, I actually need to go back and re-listen to the interview with JMS. One thing of note was his mention of movie options he has. At one point, JMS mentions a reboot or re-envisioning of Babylon 5. That thought made me stop and think, given Hollywood's current trend of rebooting, re-envisioning of classic shows, would a reboot of B5 be a good... would a reboot of B5 be good, or would a new storyline spinoff be better? What's your take on it?
Well, JMS does own the movie rights to Babylon 5. He may not own the TV rights, the merchandising rights, or anything like that, but he has firm control on that. So his intentions have really not been to do a reboot. He wants to use, as far as I know, the original cast, or at least the surviving members of the cast, should a movie ensue. And that was why he stopped the first serious movie discussion that was on the table for Babylon 5 to begin with. So I don't foresee JMS approving a reboot anytime in the near future, at least as a movie.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what he does there. But I, you know, as far as a reboot goes, I think Babylon 5 in that sense has a difference, two differences as opposed to, say, something like a Star Trek or like any number of the comic book films that have come out. Number one is it's still a relatively fresh concept. As you point out, Gary, you know, JMS wants to use all the original actors in the film to play those roles. And part of the reason he can do that is that for the most part, they are still youthful enough that it would be conceivable that you could find them doing the things that you might want them doing in such an a movie or whatever story. The other part of it is, I think it's that universe has so many interconnected tales, or it's such an already richly imagined universe that I think that, and that the fan base has bought into that concept, that I think if he went and told new stories within the universe with different characters, I think that fans would still go to see it. I think that the successive crusade amongst the fans is indicative of that. I think that had it really been given a real shot from Sci-Fi Channel, I think that Legend of the Rangers probably would have found that footing as well. You know, whereas Star Trek, I think that because there was never really a plan in that universe about stories, they just kind of like made shows about different groups of people, but I don't think that there was any, you know, a sense of how it all worked together. That's why I don't think some of those other Star Trek shows are as successful. Does that make any sense?
Does any of it really?
Well, that's why I'm asking Gary. I know what you're going to say.
Oh, no, I see what you're saying. Sort of Babylon 5 is a story from, you know, basically beginning to end, and it's, you know, all linked together so that, you know, from the pilot, you get touches of that at the, you know, in Sleeping in Light. It's a pocket universe that sort of melts itself together. It's hard to strip out an individual section. Could it be filled in with some more details and things? Yes. Or added on after the whole occurrence, but to chop it up, it's hard to make the whole thing flow if you break up the pieces.
Right. Right. Well, and even beyond that, I mean, JMS has mentioned that he had an outline of events from like the beginning of the universe to the end of the universe. You know, if maybe not in any detail like you're saying, but that still speaks to an overall plan, and Star Trek never had that.
Oh, no. It was this week, what planet are we on? You know?
Yeah, right.
As much as I love the show, it was a limiting format for a long, long time.
Right. Okay, here's another email for us. This comes to us from Maureen Cruz. And she writes, I'm slowly catching up. I'm up to number 129. Maureen, you're a long ways back. She says, being unemployed has some benefits, not many, but a few. But I just had to ask, what happened to Yarsto? Haven't heard his messages for a long time.
Go ahead, Tim.
Go ahead, Gary. No, you go.
Well, I'm still involved with Three Edged Sword. As a matter of fact, I still got to finish my latest scripts that came in. Yes, I got till Friday. Take it easy. Anyway.
mine are done.
I know, I saw. And basically, Yarsto got a real job, and it's taken a lot of his time. And since this happens in the middle of the night for him in the Netherlands, it's just a little too much for him to show up every time and to, you know, have a real job. So he's, you know, cut back a lot of this and put some time into Three-Edged Sword. And so he still is alive and well. Although I still wonder if he's really a computer or not. He's never sent me a picture to prove otherwise.
And I can tell you from what little I've read of the scripts, I only read my parts as much because I don't want to be as spoiled as I could be. I think the next four episodes of Three-Edged Sword are going to be really fantastic.
Oh, you know, they look really good. How these guys can keep writing this stuff and keep it, you know, interesting and, you know, just, you know, weaving together their storyline. It's just, it's really incredible. I don't think I could have written a story over this length of episodes already.
And have it be as strong as it's been. You know, they have been moving toward a point and toward a resolution. It's really interesting. I'm really, really pleased. Happy to be involved in my own little way.
Oh, me too. And I just hope they don't kill either of us off.
Well, that's the one thing about being an ISN. You know, you could, there's always need for someone to read the news.
That's true. Well, I always had a joke when Yarso had first offered me the role. I just said, as long as you don't kefirize me, because he had made me a fighter pilot, I said I'd be fine.
Very nice. Okay, here comes another one. This comes to us from Michael. He says, hi, Tim. One tiny point stood out to me as missing in the outstanding interview you and Summer had with the Great Maker. You said that you didn't understand why people, presumably industry types, didn't recognize the origin of several innovative ideas directly attributable to B5 and to Joe. Joe mentioned that people don't see the show on TV anymore, so there was little remaining with any audience other than the fans. I take issue with that based on what I know about persistent cultural remainders. Some things do remain with the general public long after the content is relegated to the specialist or fan niche. This is an extract from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, a show on National Public Radio from May 30 of this year. It's this year. And he did send a link, but I didn't get that up to Michael, so I'll have to post that up later. He says, these people are not talking about sci-fi or genre or anything remotely related. The question about geeks brought out an unsolicited and totally out-of-the-blue reference to the B5 chat room. This is something I notice all the time. Persistent cultural remainders. It used to happen in language a lot, but now because of our media saturation, it's happening with radio, TV, and now the internet. You can gauge the accuracy of this theory by the audience reaction. A reference to a chat room in response to a technical comment would have been interesting and coincidental, but the mention of the B5 chat room is a specific instance of just this phenomenon. Beam Me Up Scotty is like this, although Scotty never heard Kirk say this on air. Joe may not have wanted to accept the longevity of his contribution through the chat rooms and news groups, but he is definitely responsible for a portion of this phenomenon. Once again, congratulations and thank you for a jaw-dropping two-part interview. You know, I remember making that comment that that Michael is mentioning about, you know, my original thought that maybe B5 is sort of fading. And I have to say that I'm starting to take that back. I've run into about three or four other reminders that B5 is kind of at that place that maybe Star Trek was at in its original run in the early 70s, just on the cusp of maybe becoming something bigger. Someone sent me an image today. I'm going to get that posted up the website. It's basically a series of concentric circles, Earth at the bottom of the image, and the circles going outward represent astronomically noted stars, where the various television and radio signals that have been transmitted from Earth are at. And sure enough, it's a little closer into Earth, but sure enough, Babylon 5 is listed in there on one of the rings. In the B5 mail group, the JMS mail group, somebody notes that Straczynski's birthday is noted on both the Simpsons and Futurama calendars now.
Well, I don't doubt that it's settling into whatever niche that it'll settle into, whether it if it was on the air, I think somewhere, anywhere, it would start to pervade more maybe into the culture or to people in general. But given the fact that, you know, Babylon 5, as well as all the PTEN shows, just are stuck in some sort of syndication prison, you know, just doesn't bode well for the series.
Yeah, I know.
But, I mean, if we could...
I'm living in denial, maybe.
Well, if they could get them, you know, on the air, just airing somewhere, I don't doubt that a groundswell would start to build up again a little bit. But, you know, with the only real option being DVD, you know, it's something that has to be, you know, searched out as opposed to happened upon.
Right, right. Good point. All right. Well, that's it for all our emails and voicemails for today. Anybody else have any last thoughts for tonight?
Well, I just want to thank you, Tim, Jeffrey, as well as the Missing Summer for having me on. It's always a pleasure. I enjoy all my contributions. If you feel the need to dump my voicemails, that's fine. I'll keep calling anyway. But just thanks again for doing this show. I really enjoy it. I get a lot out of it, both listening to it live and later recorded. I hope everybody does too.
Well, the fun thing about, you know, the live feed, you get all the raw essence of it. But with the edited show that gets out, you get those marvelous GoToMeeting ads that we produce. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Absolutely.
Thank you for filling in for Summer, too. We appreciate that. You're sort of the go-to guy whenever the seat is vacant.
Yeah, and it was very much a last-minute kind of call, and we appreciate you being available.
Oh, anytime, guys. You know I pitch in as much as I can for this show. It's my favorite.
We're actually going to rename it just the Gary Alon 5 TV podcast.
Yeah. I'll settle for the occasional Gary Palooza. Thanks.
Gary Palooza.
Very good. All right. Well, if you want to contribute and get Gary to make comment on your voicemail next time he fills in, or your email, you can send us an email at Summer does this, and I don't do this. This is why it's so awkward. Yes, you go to the website and post comments up there, www.babylonpodcast.com. That's the website. Go visit. We have email address at babylonpodcast@gmail.com. We'll go through that and filter it out. And you might even get a response from me at some point. That would be nice. You could also leave a voicemail like Gary knows how to do. If you don't have it on speed dial,
Gary, tell us the
Gary,
number.
What
Gary.
Is it?
What's the number, Gary?
Oh, God, I didn't know I was going to be put on the spot. I do speed dial it. 228-2259?
No. Oh, and I can't check it because we're on Skype, and if I go check the number, it'll blow up. All right, this is what you do. Go back
See
to
that,
last
Summer?
Week's
hey, Summer,
show.
Are you listening? Summer, we're screwed without you. That's all I can say, Summer.
Yeah.
Maybe I mentioned it in Deep Geeking. I'm not sure.
I don't know. Well, it's here, the year that Summer wasn't here to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Let me try to do it. Let me see if I can help you here. What does Summer always say? She says, or you can call us on your voicemail, on our voicemail. The number is, that number, is, doesn't she say that? That number is,
yeah,
and then you
yeah.
then you do it.
No, she says no, she does the whole number. 226 something, yeah. something, oh, something, 2259.
Okay.
Something 2259, and then...